Welcome to Making and Breaking Social Policy, a podcast about how we collectively respond to big social issues and what this means for social and community practice. My name is Ben Lohmeyer, and I am a lecturer and researcher in social work at Flinders University. My special guest for this episode is the Honourable Nat Cook MP, Minister for Human Services in the South Australian Malinauskas Labor Government. Nat Cook is the member for Hurtle Vale. She and her husband, Neil, have lived in the same home in Woodcroft for almost 30 years. After losing their son, Sam, to a violent and unprovoked one-punch assault in 2008, Nat and Neil formed the Sammy D Foundation to educate youth about the consequences of violence. Prior to being elected to the South Australian Parliament in 2014, Nat worked for nearly 30 years as a registered nurse. As Minister for Human Services, Nat is committed to contributing to public policy that in particular strengthens the community and supports vulnerable South Australians with advocacy in key areas including disability, housing and homelessness. So we recognise that Flinders Social Work operates on the traditional lands and waters of the Kaurna people. We pay respect to their elders, past, present and emerging. We acknowledge their sovereignty and continued responsibility to care for country. So the Honourable Nat Cook MP, Minister for Human Services, thank you so much for joining me for a chat today about housing and homelessness in South Australia. Congratulations on your recent electoral success. It's really a privilege to have a little bit of your time.
Thanks so much, Ben. I as well would love to acknowledge stolen Kaurna land that's never been ceded. I pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present and emerging, but also acknowledge that I may well be appearing on many other First Nations lands across our beautiful nation and elsewhere. So acknowledge all elders and emerging leaders in our First Nations people.
So to start us off, let's talk about something that both you and I are passionate about, young people. I have a quote here from a piece in The Conversation from last October by Peter Martin, who was a visiting fellow at Crawford School of Public Policy at Australian National University. The quote goes like this. So on average, it takes a 24 to 35-year-old 9 years of tucking away one-fifth of their income each year to save for a typical Sydney deposit for a house from up from about 5 or 6 years a decade ago. Okay, so it's okay if you have a parent who can get their hands on money, but it's almost impossible if you don't. So in the words of former Reserve Bank official Peter Tulip, it's making home ownership hereditary. So this isn't just an eastern state problem, as that quote suggests. According to InDaily, here in Adelaide, houses prices increased by 25% last year. So my question is, what can we do about the generation of young people being locked out of the housing market by these skyrocketing housing prices?
Yeah, well, it's not a new problem, is it? Everyone, I'm sure, tuned in and listening would be aware that this is a generational challenge, although I would say it's getting exponentially worse as the generations go on. I think there's a few things attributing to that, a few factors. So if we think very carefully about the situation of young people and work, for example, we have got an extraordinary casualisation of the workforce where also entry-level jobs are really hard to come by. Those jobs are disappearing. Secure jobs are disappearing. And so income is unsteady, uncertain. And that creates a whole range of stresses and anxieties for young people entering the, adulting 101 world that we probably entered a lot easier decades gone by. When we did have housing challenges then, I remember back, when I rode a camel to school sort of, the interest rates were, 16, 15%. And had it not been for very creative accounting on my part and beautiful home start type loans, I never would have got into a home, when I did. But my mountain was absolutely just a molehill compared to what people are facing now. I think what I want to say to people as well, we now have a premier in Peter Malinauskas, who has dedicated his life, his working life, to ensuring that young people and people in jobs that are certainly at the behest of business owners who would like to make a profit in retail. So he's dedicated his life to make sure that people have got safe and secure jobs in retail as much as possible. So we have somebody at the absolute highest level in government who has dedicated his life to ensuring the rights of young people in the workplace have been protected and acknowledged. So I think that's a really important thing for everyone to think about. But going back to that challenge, when you said something like in the words of or to quote somebody, I just my mind immediately went to our Prime Minister, I think it was, that said, get your parents to shell out. I mean, that is just not a practical thing for the vast majority of young people. And even if it is, it's not what people want. People want to grow and learn and earn and own and take the pathway to adulting themselves in an independent way. My kids don't want me to shell out. They want to actually, get their path to independence by themselves. And that's how we bring our kids up, right? Not to put their hand out to say, oh, give me some money, Mum. I want to put a deposit on a house. And quite frankly, you know, that's not like $2,000 or $3,000 like it used to be. We're talking like $50,000, So I think it is different, and shelling out is not an option for the vast majority. And so policymakers can't set the policies or have the economic platform in our community to expect people to shell out for their kids. So we need to really look closely at how we set the policies and have the settings so that people can create an independent pathway for themselves. I think one of the things that really concerns me over the past couple of years, and we've been watching, what is now the tsunami of mental health following that preemptive sort of storm of COVID. The mental health complications are now going to make being able to build that confidence and build that ability to secure a home actually make it more difficult. So I think home ownership on a background of pre-COVID challenges around casualisation of the workforce, now exacerbated by reducing levels of confidence and increasing challenges of mental health, is going to make that home ownership thing all that much worse. Look, it's not all doom and gloom. There are things out there, and of course, you know, it's now my job to make sure that there's more things out there to make it more possible for people to enter into the housing market. Home start loans were something I referred to before. I mean, that's been around for a number of decades now. And like I said, it was a product that got me into my first home. Home start offer seminars. They offer, you know, really the nuts and bolts of how to in terms of affording and purchasing a home for people who can get to that level. There's a whole range of products that are out there, including low interest, low deposit type loans to try and help people as well to get into that that market. Of course, you know, for people who are struggling and sleeping, you know, night about on a different couch, this is a completely irrelevant conversation, right? But you know, we've got to make sure that we can try and lift people through that trajectory to home ownership if that's what they are able to achieve. The Home Seeker website is a state government website that I'm aware of. That has actually been around under a number of names for quite a number of years. It does aim to support people on low to moderate incomes into home ownership. You know, I hesitate to say the word affordable housing, like to purchase affordable properties, and they do have some properties in the high 200s to 300,000 mark, which, you know, for some people, if they do manage to secure permanent, decent paying jobs as a young person, that is something that people can aim for. But obviously, that's not going to be available for everybody, and it's down the track for some. I think one of the things that's happened, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, one of the things that has happened in the past couple of years was that we needed to have some sort of stimulus happen to the building market, and we wanted to make sure there was a pipeline for the construction industry, which of course ensures good paying jobs. So the federal government set up that home builder program where people could invest in new builds. If they had enough money already as a deposit, they could bump that up and invest in a new build. And then also people who had a home could invest in some renovations. Why I raise that is, yeah, that was great if you already had capacity to buy a home or you already had a home. But what it has done, and I think in retrospect we'll look back and we'll go, perhaps too much of a good thing is not what we want, because it has put enormous pressure on the supply markets for both trades and building materials, and it's almost pricing homes and construction out of the market. So while it was great and kept jobs in, I think now what we're seeing is that people on very low incomes are finding it a huge challenge to be able to actually compete and get into the market. So there are some challenges around that. I think there's other products like shared equity, which really is shared ownership. So, you know, there are some products out there. There are things available, but I think we've got to recognise that there are massive challenges at the moment. But you have got people now in the government at the highest level who have dedicated their life to trying to ensure that we've got public policy that brings everyone along and treats everyone equally.
Thank you so much for outlining in particular some of those policies that have been implemented historically. I think that's really great to have a sense of the, you know, these long-standing projects like HomeStart and HomeSeeker and some of those push and pull factors like stimulus. It's really striking for me, I think, and you're highlighting it, it's almost worth restating because it's so easy to overlook it. You know, this little take that we've got here from the conversation mentions 24 to 35-year-olds, right, where this is actually an age group which are typically older than what we'd think of as youth and young people. And it's great that you were mentioning we've got a Premier of South Australia who has interest in things like casualisation and retail work. But even what it's describing here is people who are probably have careers in, you know, a highly skilled area of some sort, or at least you would expect to by that typical age. And even they are struggling to really save a deposit in this space. There's some great research that's getting a little bit old now out of University of Melbourne's Youth Research Centre, which has taught the life patterns research. And they followed generations of young people through university to watch some of these markers like home ownership shifting through, you know, older into older generations. So where previously, you know, around 18 years of age, when we think of young people becoming an adult, you might be able to tick off some of those life achievements like starting a family and buying a house and those sort of things. But we're seeing that pushed back well into people's 30s now, which is, you know, it's kind of understated how much of a massive shift that is in people's lives. So thank you for outlining some of those. I think, you know, there's a lot of clear, large structural problems here as well. But one of the other key parts to what you were describing was also some of the social housing components. And last year on your website, you revealed that under the previous government, we had 2,000 housing SA properties, so social housing, that were not being used. And for broader kind of national context, it's worth noting that the data suggests that wait times for public housing nationally can be up to 5 years. So there's a significant need of people who need social housing, need that support. There's appears to be some housing that's not being utilised. And prior to sort of the eligibility changes that happened here in South Australia, there were some reports from 2020 of 20,000 people on the waiting list. So again, like another massive issue. How can we go about providing better social housing to this large group of people who need it?
Supply, absolutely supply. So it's important to note, yes, the numbers of social housing properties have gone down over the years, but South Australia still has as a percentage, a higher level of social housing than other states. So we still do have a reasonable amount. However, it's clear that the amount that we have, it's not purely about looking at the numbers, it's about looking at the need. So there are quite a lot of people on the waiting list. Some of those numbers now are a little bit different, but in the broad context, having thousands of public homes empty for long periods of time is not meeting the community expectation. You're always going to have a portion of homes empty because there's this, you know, churn of people moving out and upgrades or modifications needing to be made in the time between someone exits to someone letting. And as the biggest landlord, of course, you expect a number of houses to be empty while they're re-tenanted. However, I think it's not good enough that that number has remained so high for so long. So when we were making our policy announcements ready for the election recently, there were a couple of things we've targeted. So we've targeted building of new homes. So in a package of about $181 million over the next few years, Labor has committed to build 400 new homes, and some of those will absolutely happen in the regional parts of South Australia where there is a real crisis in homelessness now that's emerged over recent years. And also we recognise that some of the homes that are empty require quite significant upgrades. So we've allocated also within that budget 350 of those homes to be on the receiving end of a significant upgrade. So we're talking tens of thousands of dollars to bring them up to scratch and up to standard so that we can re-tenant them. Also within that, we will do take a real dive into the maintenance backlog, which is in the thousands as well, and invest smaller amounts per home to 3,000 public houses to do a maintenance blitz to help to alleviate some of that backlog. So I'm currently now in the great position to be able to work with the Housing Authority to identify some of those targets. So that's by suburb and regional town, and try and get some better quality houses up for reallocation and re-tenanting. So that will help, obviously, to get people in. I think in terms of the waiting times and the waiting numbers, look, there are people who wait much longer than 5 years for public housing. And so that is that other end of the market, the purchasing and private rental, which is also under massive pressure from an affordability point of view. I think, you know, 25-30% rent increases are nothing sort of surprising. And I think mortgage, to purchase now, some of the suburbs that were quite affordable have had 50 or so percent bumps in their value in recent times. So there's a whole range of stuff that needs to be looked at. And I think it's very important that leading into what is a federal election, I think for people, particularly in the social services sector, to be aware of what is being offered federally from a policy point of view. I think there is a stark contrast. I don't know whether your students out there, anyone watching, did you listen to the budget last week and the budget reply? And I didn't hear much from the government at all in the way of social housing investment. But I think it's really important that federal Labor have committed to create a $10 billion Housing Australia Future Fund, which over the next 5 years or so will build, I think it's 30,000 properties. And within that, of course, create thousands of jobs. But the investment returns from this Futures Fund will then be invested into building. And I think the breakdown is 20,000 social housing properties with some targets for women and children fleeing domestic violence, which is absolutely vital, and also older women on low incomes, which we know is one of the fastest growing homelessness demographics in our community. And on top of that, then there's about 10,000 homes to be built for frontline workers so that they can actually be living near their places of work. So we're talking nurses, et cetera, emergency service workers. So there is a combination there which will inject much needed money into social housing, which we know, as you know, is a combination of public and community housing providers. So we will see, if there is a federal Labor government, an injection into social housing like I'm sure the generations have not seen. So I'm pretty excited about the prospect and hope that the people who are listening are equally as excited and talk about that a lot with their friends. A shameless plug. But I think, honestly, it's really, really important. So we need to increase supply. We need to turn that supply over and we need to make it available for people.
Thank you. And no worries about the shameless plug. That's fine. I mean, you're welcome to come on and tell us a bit about what you're up to. That's what we really want to know. You know, we want to hear about how we can invest in these spaces, how we can address some of these issues. I mean, it's all those sound great, but the problem still sounds a bit bigger than what, you know, we're responding to at the moment. And I keep thinking, you know, there's some examples of things like so some data from the Adelaide Zero Project from April in 2020 showed that as an emergency response to the pandemic, homelessness was basically eradicated in the CBD. So the short version is that homeless people were given opportunity to go into hotels. So doesn't this kind of show us that homelessness is basically a policy choice? Like, if we wanted to end homelessness, could we do it?
Well, well may you ask. Absolutely. Before going out of government, I was the signatory as the assistant minister to an agreement to eliminate homelessness in the Adelaide CBD, supported by the Zero Project. When you talk about homelessness being a policy choice, it takes my mind to Joseph Stiglitz's lecture. I'm not sure whether you attended it. It was here in Adelaide, where I believe he said something like poverty is a policy choice. Sure. If we consider what we do as a government to the community in terms of policy, we can tip very strong, very resilient people who have got comorbidities or challenges in their life absolutely over into vulnerability, which will, as a consequence, see people living in poverty. And if we don't have policy settings in housing and social services sectors, particularly thinking about the rate of, any sort of supplement payment, you know, be it disability pension, be it job seeker, you know, any of those payments, if we don't make sure they keep step with what's required, we tip people into homelessness through policy choice. So I think it is in part, but of course we can all as a community make these decisions by how what governments we elect and how we lobby governments as a group or as individuals in our electorates. So we need to make sure we have the right policies, making the right choices, and quite frankly, that's what makes me feel just so humbled and burst with excitement about the opportunity. As somebody who cares deeply about the consequences of choices, to be offered, if I was to write my path, 10 years ago, about if you were an MP, Nat, what job would you like to do? It would say human services. My background is nursing, but my pathway through community work, through our foundation, and the choices that watching the choices that people can make and the consequence on others. These choices that I now am able to be part of from a policy point of view, I hope that homefulness is a policy choice. I hope that strengthening our community is a policy choice. If we can basically get people off the streets within weeks into accommodation because of a pandemic, we should be able to get people off the streets because it's the right thing to do. Now, it is impossible to snap your finger and make life perfect for everybody, but we need to look at what that context needs to include, and it's how to manage and support people with mental health problems, drug and alcohol addictions, people with generational poverty, people who have not been offered the opportunity to learn life skills that are going to enable them to maintain tenancy, making sure we've got investment in community sector so that there are places for people to go to get support, be it a youth centre, be it a community centre, making sure that our health system is well resourced. Part of our housing commitment with the building of the 400 houses, that included 50 housing outcomes or 50 homes for people with a supportive wraparound service provision model. People would be familiar with those models that exist already, such as Common Ground. Those types of housing outcomes are really important for people, like I've said, that have got a complex trajectory to homelessness. So I am really determined to do the very best job I can to advocate to get these changes and get these policy settings so that homelessness is not the policy choice, it's homefulness. I think that it's next year that the agreement nationally for homelessness funding comes up for re-signing. Well, anyone out there listening that wants to help to lobby, let's keep an eye on when these agreements are going to get signed, because we can't leave it until 11:59 p.m. when the agreement is due at midnight. We need to start preparing ourselves. We need to talk to the sector, talk to participants, and make sure we've got the very best possible pathway to have a smooth transition to a new agreement, so we aren't leaving workers uncertain, we aren't leaving workers in a position where they are making a choice to move on because they haven't been given a guarantee of their work. I think those sort of things are very, very important, and I think for me, being able to look at people in our community that are facing homelessness as a challenge or disability, for me, it is one of the biggest privileges and gifts that I could ever be given. But also, people in the community can also make a difference, make a choice. Coming up to winter, you know, don't forget that just a little bit can go such a long way in terms of some of the appeals that will be happening. And you know, while government plays a massive role in terms of funding service organisations, the community too can make a massive difference. And I think about some of those organisations, particularly some that sort of were cut from the homelessness sector, Catherine House, Vinnie's, Hutt Street, you know, reach out and see what you can do to make a difference too, because, you know, changing the world one conversation at a time is what we're all there for, right?
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Look, I really appreciate, again, sort of pointing out some of the key projects that already exist, as well as the national agreement, flagging that as something that's coming up soon. That's a great opportunity, particularly for students and practitioners who are really in this space, to get in early and start thinking about some advocacy there. But the idea of homefulness as a policy choice is really exciting. So I look forward to seeing that in action as well. Look, thank you so much for this chat. It's been really great. If people wanted to hear more about, you know, the kind of work that you're up to, where's the simplest way to kind of keep track of that? Where should they go?
Yeah, so we will start uploading more things as my team gets together on my website. But of course, DHS is a easily searchable website on Google. So just search for the Department of Human Services and you'll find it. There's also the Human Services Facebook. If people want to get in touch with us, there is Minister Human Services at sa.gov.au. So please just reach out. Soon we'll be offering opportunities to engage. We're looking at, lived experience as the heart of policy making from my point of view. So that will cover a range of different portfolios within the one big topic of human services. So thanks for the opportunity. I've enjoyed it.
That's great. Thanks again for coming on. It's been a really good conversation.
No worries. Ciao.
This episode was edited by Ryan Manhire, music by Anthem of Rain, sourced from the freemusicarchive.org. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter at LohmeyerBen. If you like the podcast, please like, share, comment, and do all the things.